As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the third in the podcast mini-series that we are running during the Six Nations, How to Win a Grand Slam. I'm Owen Slott, the Chief Rugby Correspondent of The Times. This week's guest I loved because he never really thought he'd get close to his national team, let alone a Grand Slam, and yet he ended up with three of them. This is Adam Jones, the Wales tight head from 2003 and then for over a decade thereafter. Here he is honest, sometimes searingly so, surprisingly so, about what it took to win trophies that in Wales many thought they would never win again. So I'm delighted to be sitting here with Adam Jones. Adam, great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on this great podcast, How to Win a Grand Slam. You've got a fair bit of experience in that yourself.
Yeah, I like to remind The English boys and the English fans up in Quinns that they've won a few. So I don't seem too big-headed, but like to remind them every now and again.
You've got something to talk about.
Well, may as well. You get better with the age, don't you? So I was a much better player now than I was then. So I like to remind people.
Oh, I don't think so. Anyway, listen. Let's go back to sort of where it started. When you were a kid, you didn't actually want to win Grand Slams for Wales, did you? You wanted to be an All Black.
yeah. It was weird because obviously, growing up in the 80s in Wales, it wasn't, apart from maybe 87, 88, it wasn't the most successful time of the, ever. Mm-hmm. And then the turn of, 80s to 90s, a lot of boys went to rugby league. And for some reason, my parents always, especially my mother, who was always a massive All Blacks fan, and it probably started. We, just down the road from me, it was a little village called Ystalyfera, and there was a sports shop there. And Clive Rowlands, who was, coached Wales, managed the Lions, played for Wales 14 times, captain 14, he had a sports shop there. And he always used to say that the All Blacks always wore their socks up and always had shorts without pockets in them. So, and for some reason, that stuck in my head that I wanted to be like these guys, and he'd always shout at me if I had my hands in my pockets. So, and then the All Blacks were obviously really good. They won the World Cup and then, beat Wales in 88. So I was, just kind of infatuated by them. Like many people have been, these sort of mythical guys in black jerseys and, actively encouraged to follow them by my mother and father. So,
But am I right that you're sort of the highest moment of following or a role model in a Wales jersey was naming your goldfish after a Wales player?
Yeah, it was. 88, that was the year they won the Triple Crown. And named after Bledin Bowen.
Right, because so that's how you honoured that victory.
Yes, and I think it was, apparently the goldfish lasted 5 years, but I don't know whether they doubled up a few times with my parents. But
the point really is that you grew up not thinking that the Welsh rugby was going places that
no, not at all, no. It was, I think it was 1991 then, I remember watching the game in my house. Wales played France, and I think it was in the Parc de France, and we lost quite handily. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember saying to my mother, I was embarrassed to be Welsh.
And really?
Which was followed then by a stiff right-hander behind the back of the head. So it was, regardless of what Wales are doing in rugby, we never say that. And so it's kind of a very passionate Welshman, and I'd never say that now, but at the time it just felt like, we couldn't buy a win, so it lost all these superstars to league, Moriarty, Jonathan Davis, Devereux, all these guys, and lost some serious talent there, and so Dai Young and Richard Webster, these type of fellas, and we lost 6 or 7, 8, 9, probably good international class players, and then replaced them with, in the end turned out to be good, like Jinx and Scott Gibbs and these guys, but it was a tough sort of transition phase, and as a kid growing up, it wasn't an easy watch.
But you didn't grow up thinking, I want to be that guy wearing the shirt of Wales. I mean, from what I gather, your ambition was You loved the village Abercrave that you came from, and you thought that that was where rugby players would play. You play for your village team, correct?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think it is very tribal. It's very, you know, it was a local, so Abercrave and then Estragon Lice is like 4 miles down the road. You know, it was a massive rivalry. Very much again, like women from the village, you know, like my mother and a few other of the guy, those type of people, you know, very, you know, I wasn't allowed to play for Estragon Lice, even though it was, you know, but I mean, every Saturday you always looked up to the boys in the rugby club, you know, but certainly when it came to an age of 13, 14, 15, when there was Sunday rugby, like a lot of these valleys, there's always like local rivalry, and as you said, the rugby players were the rock stars, you know, they'd be the ones singing, the ones drinking Saturday night, and you looked up to them. And regardless of what sort of how good they were, what league they were in, but you know, you still looked up to them and wanted to be them. And my dad playing rugby there as well, you know, he was captain of the club a few times, and so you looked up to him as well. So it was, he always wanted to play for the club.
Was that the heights of where you envisaged yourself going?
Oh yeah, massive. I never I think because I was quite I wasn't massive as a kid. I was quite like big. I wasn't like fat, I was just quite a bigger than average kid, and I was quite quick at the time. I lost all that. I lost any pace when I started playing professional, realising I was very slow when I started playing professional rugby. But I just wanted to play rugby. I wanted to play youth rugby for Abercrave. I wanted the sing songs. I wanted the Art of Ale. I wanted the beer. I wanted the beer tokens, or, you know, if you played to the first team, you'd get a tracksuit top. You know, I never aspired to be Wales, and a Welsh player, never. So there wasn't anyone particularly I looked up to in the Welsh squad at the time who I wanted to be. You know, maybe as I said, Dai Young had gone, who was, you know, obviously a fantastic player, but you know, I never, there was no one like that though. I thought I want to be like him. I was happy to go along. I was a decent player. Look, I played a bit of county, I played a bit of district rugby, but I never quite took the next step to like any. Like the furthest I went was sort of you know, West Wales and the 16s or something. It was never any further than that. So it was, and I never had any ambition because there was no, well, there wasn't academies.
Yeah.
So there was no, I didn't really want to, you know, I didn't have the sort of the option to go in there. You always kind of picked up by, you know, from a local, like from a Neath or a Swansea, by a scout, so to say, you know.
Well, I get the impression that you were always slightly surprised when someone tapped you on the shoulder and said, oh, would you like to kind of try out for this next level up?
Or yeah.
You never actually thought I belong there. It was just.
No, sort of, I don't think so. I knew you kind of like being a good player, and you know, I liked in youth being like probably the best player in my youth team. You know, you enjoy that, and then it's how you react. And when you go to a different, like I never really, when I went to county games, I was never like a start. I was off the bench, or and I didn't really, you know, push myself forward. And it was you know, I never expected to be a professional player. I never definitely didn't think I could be like a first class player. Yeah. I was off asked to go to the training with Aberavon. But I was a bit nervous, so I didn't go. When I was about 18, 19, I went, me and my friend went to Llandovery pre-season training only because to try it out, because they were in like the sort of the tier below the Neath the Swansea's, and it was free food after training, so we used to drive over the mountain to Llandovery once or twice a week, and I was asked to come and play for Llandovery. But then I just didn't I'd never really wanted to actually commit fully to it. And
so you didn't play for them?
No, I played for them in the end when I was with Neath on loan,
right?
But when I was actually asked to at the time and place there, I just like, oh no, it's alright, I'm okay, don't I was a bit shy, I was a bit nervous really. I didn't really think, like I thought I was a good player, a decent player, but I never thought, oh, yeah, I reckon it's probably intimidated to go, you know. I wasn't a tough player, you know. I was, I probably shied away for any sort of confrontation or any challenge, so I just didn't want to put myself out there, really.
Did you ever feel, and I guess this may be more when you were an international player, but a Welsh prop was supposed to be a different personality to the one you've just described. a Wales prop was supposed to be big and hard and not take a backward step or whatever, and you saying you were shy and you didn't want you avoided confrontation. That's the person you were.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of it hasn't changed now. You know, you sort of grow out of it a bit. But definitely. I think when I first got on the Welsh squad, even, you know, it was still because I looked like I did. You know, I was still, should we say, carrying a bit of puppy fat. They had curly hair. You know, I didn't look like people they'd expect to. Look like as a Welsh prop. And you know, I remember Bobby Windsor used to get into me quite a bit about it, not personally, but through the press, you know, how I wasn't, you know, good enough, and then you know, how I shouldn't be in the score, you know, I'm not fit enough, you know, all this type of stuff. But then kind of sending my dad kind of takes great pleasure in the fact in his book then, he actually said I was Wales's most important player. So, like, 8 years later, I was, Bobby Owens had actually come around to me slowly. So it was, I knew who Bobby Windsor was, but, you know, I didn't pay much attention to it. But any sort of criticism hurt. You know, I got a fair bit of that sort of thing. So, that, you know, it took me a while to get past that, really. And, you know, I took it a lot to heart. As I said, I wasn't confrontational. I wasn't like a minor, although I come from, like, my grandfather's a minor and, you know, family. Yeah. I wasn't like that type of hard.
So you just didn't fit the stereotype?
No, not at all, I don't think.
And it was a stereotype, because there were probably loads of people like you that didn't fit it.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe you had to pretend they did or whatever.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like a lot of it, so, you know, rugby's a lot of it's bravado and, it's like a cricketer, I suppose, like an opening batsman when there's 90-mile-an-hour balls hitting you in the ribs and you've got to show you're not hurt. Mm. And, you know, I guess it's a bit like that, being, especially in the front row, you know, you've got to act away when you're not necessarily like that. And sometimes it's easy to hide, but sometimes, sometimes it comes out then, it's hard then.
When times did get hard for you at the early stages of your career, and I think when you started playing for Wales and you were offended or upset about what was going on, your reaction was to turn to food, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah, massively. It's probably seeing it a little bit now, I guess. Right. But, 100%. You know, I remember, so the World Cup was 2003, got down to a good weight, trained well. Andrew Hoare, the fitness coach at the time, Steve Anson, you know, the coach, got me into good shape. And then, yeah, played well. And then, I got subbed after half hour. That's a half hour again. And then, obviously, didn't know anything about it. And then after that, I got injured in the Six Nations. And then from being probably the Six Nations, I was 120 kilos. Probably 2 months later, I was up to 133.
Really?
Just eating, drinking, just not being professional. And that was my sort of comfort and coping mechanism with it all. So,
Of course, was a backfiring
mechanism. Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. You know, the only good thing for me was Steve Hansen left and Mike Rudder came in and, he wanted me to be involved somehow. So, you know, that was obviously give me a bit more of a carrot to get back down there.
So just go back to when you started playing regularly for Wales, which was around the time of the build-up to 2003 yeah. World Cup and then the World Cup and then 2004, your first Six Nations campaign, Steve Hansen was selecting you to start.
Yes.
But was taking you off after half an hour.
Yes.
And that's pretty damn unusual.
It was at the time, yeah. And it doesn't happen much now. It doesn't happen now. Well, I see it every now and again.
And you understandably found that upsetting because that was humiliating for you, I guess.
Yeah, more massive, yeah. Oh, it was embarrassing, it was humiliating, yeah, I was devastated. I think if I'd known, I would have found it easier.
Yeah.
But it was just like when you see a number come up at half hour gone and it's like, no, I'm not injured. And so I think if I'd known, I would have found it a bit easier to cope with. But yeah, it was just it's not just embarrassing for me; it's embarrassing for my mother and father.
Yeah, you know, everyone who would like to be feeling proud of you.
People say stuff in the crowd, don't they? So I'm imagining, you know, at the time I would have had a lot of sort of grief in the crowd, or you know, people have made comments about me. So look, it was tough for me; it was tough for them, and friends and stuff. So it was. I really did struggle a bit, but I think if I hadn't. I think it'd been a bit easier now, if you know, with the sort of coping strategies clubs have had and teams have had, psychologists or just people to speak to, you know, and you kind of just left your own devices and just eat. So that's what I did.
So that's when you turned to eating more and feeling sorry for yourself.
And then it was probably came a bit later, but like just sort of realizing, no, I'm not in a good place here. I'm heavy, and then how do I get the weight down? And then it's like starving yourself, taking laxatives. Sweatsuits, do anything to get the weight down, to sort of get picked again, really. So that probably came a little bit later on, because it wasn't quite as dramatic an increase. But if certainly any fluctuations, it was always I'd do anything.
How long would you take laxatives for then? Would that be for a prolonged period or just until the weight came down?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Just like anything. I never went down the sort of... never make myself sick or anything like that, but definitely laxatives. Like, I wouldn't eat sort of from 24 hours out before I had to get into a campaign or something. So it was a bit of an ongoing battle. Like, so, looking back now, if I just a lot of it was just down to being professional and not dealing with any setbacks or me being lazy around like not training or if I was looking back now, if it was more professional, then I wouldn't have had that issue. There was times.
If you were a different personality, then you would have felt confident enough to approach Steve Hansen, I presume, and say, "Listen, what's all this about?" Because
Well, we was after probably the England game or the New Zealand game, the first time it happened in the World Cup. Yeah. I saw him in the lift and he said, how are you feeling? I said, oh, yeah, well, not great. He said, do you know why I took you off after half an hour? And I was like, no. And he said, well, because you're not fit enough. And that was it. But I just played 80 minutes against Italy the week before. I'd man of the match. And then you're telling me that, like, it turns out that if the only reason I played 80 minutes against Italy was because Duncan broke his elbow.
Duncan Jones.
He broke his elbow in the game, or his arm in the game. And that turns out if he'd still been fit, I would have probably come off after 30 because he got taken off.
But the point is, your head coach never took you aside and said, listen, Adam, you know, you're our starter, but we don't think you're fit enough. If you work on your fitness, or
he didn't
give you a target.
There was always, and I think that's where Gats was good with me. He was always like, you know, rightly, people have got different targets, right? You know, rightly, wrongly, like his was like, if you're this weight, you know, you can play international rugby. And then I played at that weight, and then did pretty well for him for 6 years. So, and that's what I needed, you know, something sort of set in stone.
It's not complicated, is it?
No, I'm on that setting stone, and he was, yeah, and that was, you know, that's how he worked that out quite early. He brought a guy, Craig White, in, who was his guy in Wasps, and, you know, got on well with him, worked me hard, always on my back. And Andrew Hall was the same way. He was always on my back. He was always on my case about, you know, extras and fitness and, you know, doing it, you know. And you have to,
He was one of the fitness coaches.
He was the fitness coaches with Wales in 2003. So he's, you know. So if I had a fitness coach on my back, certainly, you know, that helped me. Yeah. You know, sometimes, you know, see players now, they're not, you know, if that's, they don't have that now because it's seen as probably negative to be so pushy and, you know, whatnot. But, yeah, certainly I needed that constant, you know, constant
going. Okay, it's seen as pushy to be pushing a player to work on their fitness.
Yeah, well, not pushy, but, like, they're probably to the, you know, for example, when I was poor, he'd have me doing like an hour-long bike session in the morning, bit of caffeine, burn fat like that way, which is fine, you know, it's not rocket science. But, you know, I'd say the generation now, yeah, it's not, they expected to come a bit earlier. Maybe I'm being very, what I'm used to for the last 5 years up in London, but certainly, yeah, it's harder to get them to have that drive to do it themselves, you know.
Right.
And, actually, it's almost, you. So stop picking on me then. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit like that. As another fitness coach said, if there's more calories going in than they're coming out, then you're going to put weight on. So it's like, and when you learn that, then it's easy enough, you know. You've got to do extra. So it's and it is what it is. But yeah, it's a bit different now.
So Adam, 2005 comes around. Steve Hansen's not the coach anymore. Mike Ruddock's first season as the first Six Nations as Wales coach. You've had a fair amount of time to work out what's going on in Welsh rugby, international rugby. Was there anything when that season approached that suggested to you that the team was ready to achieve something?
I think the only confidence we had was the autumn before. We pushed South Africa to a score, almost beat them, and then we pushed the All Blacks to within a score or penalty. I think we lost sort of a line out on their 22 in the last minute. So I think we had a bit of confidence from that. I think...
Were you as a player, had you by that time completely sort of buried your views of Welsh rugby that you had as a kid? As a kid you thought, Wales aren't going anywhere. By that stage, were you confident that we are a team that can achieve?
Yeah. Oh, massively. I think, my mindset had changed. It was the, like even so the 97 Lions, you know, seeing how well the Welsh boys did on that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 99, they had a good run. So... Yeah, so there was obviously a bit more. Oh, you know, Wales aren't a bad side anymore. You know, they were starting to be public figures again. You know, sort of people idolise them, and obviously Graham Henry had a massive impact with that. Brought a lot of professionalism. Steve Hansen brought a lot of professionalism, and that's what the Welsh team probably needed, a little different voice from outside. You know, a lot of people in Wales think the only reason you get a coaching job in Wales is because you got like a Australian or New Zealand accent. No, I think we were. I don't know. We probably didn't think we were going to win a Grand Slam, but we definitely had a bit of confidence coming in. You know, it was good foundations put in place by Steve and Jono and Andrew Ho. And
your first game in that season, in that championship, was a very famous, oft-remembered game against England here in Cardiff.
Yeah.
Sometimes known as Gav's game.
Gavin Henson. Yeah, that's when he made his... that's when he came on the scene. Well, I suppose it wasn't when he came on the scene, but that's when he...
stood out.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was known as Gavin's game because... two crunching tackles on the English youngster Matthew Tate, and then the phenomenal kick at the end to win it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have uncomplimentary views on Gavin Henson and his influence on, but you were a real fan of his, weren't you?
I love him. He's a great guy. Yeah, look, I like a lot of people and a lot of players. After a few beers, they can rub people out the wrong way. But you know, we had plenty of them in the Welsh team and the Ospreys team, so you kind of used to it. So no, I mean, he was a good player. He was a great player. He was obviously. It's disappointing he never quite have kind of kicked on, you know?
Yeah.
No, he did. That's probably doing him a disservice.
He didn't put together a long career, did he?
No, he was so good. He was like ridiculously good when he wanted to be, you know? And then he'd get injured or he'd have issues, you know, or he'd... But the guys who got the best out of him was, you know, Lynn Jones really got a lot out of him. Gats got a lot out of him because they kind of let him be a grown-up, you know? Yeah. It's the ones who kind of tried to... put pressure on him and you know, not to put a curfew on him, but put a lid on what he wasn't loud, he wasn't a dick, he wasn't chopsy, he wasn't anything like that, but he just had to go off the rails every now and again. But he was an unbelievable player, big, like strong.
Was he sort of a bit what maybe that Wales team needed at that time? In he had a strut and a confidence, and he looked like a show off, but Welsh players didn't feel that you could be like that.
Not on the slightest. No, he was quiet about it. He was just like a pretty shy, you know.
But on the pitch, he looked like Superman, didn't he?
Well, yeah, fake tan, shaved legs, you know, the gel in his hair, and he was almost when he took a lot of pressure off us, I guess. When Gav came along, because we beat England, and it was all the pressure on Gav, and then obviously we give Italy a bit of an opt-in, and then. The ball keeps rolling in, isn't it? And it was one of those ones where everything was around him. Any media was around Gav, so you didn't feel any sort of... it's almost like a football manager taking the pressure off the players.
Yeah.
And he loved it because he played phenomenally well that year. So it's... there's a reason you're tanning like that and you're doing your legs to look good, isn't it? So it's... and I think it wasn't long after he started seeing Charlotte as well. So I think...
So he was well set in the headlines.
So it took a lot of pressure off the boys, and he's probably one of the ones you kind of... No, not the one that got away, but he was so good when he wanted to be. He was like ridiculously world-class.
Yeah.
But then it was that always never quite backing it up. And
victory against England was followed by Italy.
Yeah.
And then the French game, which I think was quite a big personal moment in your career, a big challenge for you.
Yeah,
you were propping against Sylvain Marconnet.
Yeah.
One of the great French losers.
Yeah. It was a strange game, literally a game of two halves for us, I think. And me, definitely. Obviously, Alfie got injured and... But Mark and he—it was my first probably my first outing international level. He was giving me
your first outing.
Outing, as in getting stuffed, as in
you got outed for
being
inadequate.
Having my head shoved up my ass for the first half. So that's so that was my first time that had happened really in test matches. The amazing thing was they brought Mark and he to tight head. They took Nico Mas off, put Marconnet to tight end and put Milou, the loose head on, who wasn't as good a scrummage as Marconnet. He looked more like a French prop, you know, sort of cauliflower ears, high shorts, big chest, but wasn't as good a scrummager. So from having an absolutely Marconnet having a field day on me, we actually started getting a little bit on top of them because he wasn't a recognised tight end second half. So it worked out good for me. And then it was when I saw he wasn't coming out against me for second half, it was... one of the best, you know, maybe get a little bit more confidence.
Would that be the toughest or one of the toughest halves you've ever had in international rugby? Because not many people did anything like that to you.
To that point, yeah. Well, not that many to that point. But there's a couple against New Zealand, I guess. But no, that one was tough. It was tough. As a team as well, we weren't, if you're getting turnover in the scrum, you know, in crucial areas, then it's a tough... get field position against a big French team, and then it's like it is now.
You kind of winged your way through that game as a team, didn't you? As you say, you didn't look like you didn't have much dominance for much of the game.
We had a couple of special players, Nugget and Shane, who managed to turn the tide a bit that day.
Being Martin Williams,
yeah.
Shane Williams.
Yeah, so it was, we managed to get away with it. I think what stuck with me was the sort of rear guard towards the end when... they were pounding the line, and I think it was Servat came on an angle, and Rob McBride tackled him, opposite number, and absolutely smashed him back sort of a couple of yards, and that kind of just managed to take us home to victory, because I think we got the balls and we kicked the touchdown. So, but no, it was a good, and I think a game like that, then next game we got Scotland away, which is all right, the good side, but not the best side in the world. You know, you think, oh, could be on for a Grand Slam here, and that's when you start thinking, you know.
That's when the media start asking you, could you win a Grand Slam? And you all say, oh, we're not thinking about this at all.
You are, that's bullshit, you are. Yeah, you absolutely are, yeah. That's when the questions, when they were played last year, I got interviewed by someone, and they said, are the boys be thinking about the Grand Slam, like two games out? And I was like, well, 100%. 100% you'd be thinking, you're lying to my face if you don't think you're not thinking about the Grand Slam with two games to go.
And that's the experience you have with Markkanen. How did you handle that? Did you go away shaken?
I was a little bit, obviously gutted, I knew. But to be fair to Mike straight away, and that's a lot of things about Mike. The first day after we played France back in, he got Stuart Evans, the old Welsh prop, to come and speak to me and just go through some scrum techniques, you know, foot positioning, binds, and, you know, no one knew about this. No one, like, it was one-on-one on a day off.
What, he organised some special coaching effectively to rebuild your confidence?
Yeah, exactly. So he didn't say, oh, we've got Stuart Evans coming in to work with Adam Jones or anything like that. He just got Stuart Evans in. Yeah. He coached him at Swansea, knew him well, played for Wales, went to rugby league, you know, big man like myself, and just to iron out a few details then. So
that was good coaching.
Brilliant. And that's what people don't see, I think, and that's why I've... You know, certainly I've got a real soft spot for Mike. Mm-hmm. And I'll stick up for Mike when people, you know, seem to, you know, criticise him. Like I said, when I did my book, it was exactly the same. You know, people don't see the little things. Sometimes he did when, you know, there's other things more in the media and what players have said.
Because the extraordinary thing about a whole successful team was that by hook or by crook, Mike Ruddock was forced out within a year of the Grand Slam, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But anyway, the Grand Slam itself, so you edged your way against France, then you had a very good win against Scotland,
yeah,
and then you had Ireland at home, and then I remember that day particularly well myself, because it was, can this really happen? You know, Wales haven't won a Grand Slam since 1978.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was historical, magical, and it was. I don't know how it felt for you, but.
It was obviously before social media and all that type of stuff, but, you know, obviously I think Alan Phillips came in the morning and said there's a TV screen in across the road from where they do Winter Wonderland up there, and there's going to be like 250,000 people in the field watching the game, you know, and you're thinking, shit, this is ridiculous, this is bonkers, you know, and you realise what a big deal it is. You're driving into Cardiff, you know, we knew Ireland were a good team, they're on the cusp of their sort of golden generation, so to speak. You know,
so you felt that you were on the cusp.
Them, because they had O'Driscoll, they had.
Oh, sorry, they
yeah,
were.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Paul Connell was coming through, and all these, so they had good players. You know, so we knew they were a good side, and O'Gara, Stringer, all these sort of household names, and you know, amazing things with Munster and amazing things with Leinster, and we knew it was going to be tough, but there was a confidence and momentum, and momentum is massive in these Grand Slam games. If you get that confidence, and you know, you come into work, come to training the Monday morning, you're bouncing for it. You know, there's always a little chat about it and about the Grand Slam, and the new boys get nervous, like we all were. But then the more you play these games, the easier it becomes. Really.
Anything particularly you remember about that game?
Obviously, Gethin's charge down. I think O'Gara stamping him and throwing the ball. But no, I think we. I probably played my best game of the tournament that game. Certainly scrum wise, I think we did okay in the scrum. You know, it was physical, and it was, I think, obviously Geth's going up. They never looked like they were going to win. They never looked like they were going to threaten us too much. And we put, you know, Kevin Morgan scored that try then. And look, it was an amazing day. It's like, I'm lucky to have been a part of three Grand Slams and the championship all at home, and it's a surreal feeling going around the field, you know, waving to the fans. It was a sunny day, you know, the roof was open, so it made it a bit. Max Boyce says the gods have opened up, the heavens opened up, so God can watch us play. The sun came down. It was brilliant. It was growing up, probably not so much then, but there's always criticism from like the teams from the 70s and the. You know, the J.J. Williamses and these type of guys, you know, always they were not as good as us, and which we weren't at the time. You know, it was probably a lucky Grand Slam, if anything, if we can have one. You know, we didn't show any form, real form going into it. But no, it was nice to sort of, all right, we've got one now, and it was a surreal feeling. It was like unreal going into the Hilton Hotel on the bus. It was like, you know, it was like being a Take That. There's so many people in the crowd, you know, off the bus, you know, like. security all went and both sides just tunneled down, just thousands of people there clapping you in. And it was like 24 at the time, 23, 24, and it was just I'd come from, started playing with Neatham, it was just before I was 20, so to go from there to that within 4 years was
amazing,
bonkers.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm just interested in the ungraspable truth of where and why success comes from, because Wales had had some hard times up to then, and you lived through them. You win the Grand Slam, then I think that your following years after that, you went from first to fourth to fifth. Mm. So it just whatever the magic ingredient was, it left pretty quick.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know that there was, as we just discussed, there was this kind of an internal battle, which, you know, somehow the coach that got you the Grand Slam was shifted out. But
it's very Welsh rugby-ish. It was very, you know, it happens in Welsh rugby a lot. These crazy things happen, and
you have success, and then you find a way of picking it apart.
Yeah, and it's like when Wales won the Grand Slam last year, Wales' most successful region was supposedly going to fold and join with the Scarlet. So it's like just these sort of soap opera things always happen. And it's as a player, you kind of get used to it. But the following years, it was obviously the year later, Mike got sacked, or whatever happened with Mike, you know, no one. Sure, some people
but
know.
Why do you think it was that you got it right in 05?
Probably like
two games were phenomenally close.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think there was a sort of resilience built up by Steve and Jono and these guys. So, you know, and, you know, worked there so hard in training, probably in fitness wise, so you know you could go.
Yeah.
Andrew Hoare was still there, would still work you hard in fitness. So you knew you had that, you were able to, you know, go 80 minutes. Tactically, certainly around attack wise, it was different. So you had Steve and Jono's influence was still there. You know, running lines, it was very technical.
Steve Hansen and
Scott Johnson. So that was still very technical. You know, it wasn't like Wales had been used to before, really. It was something we hadn't seen. So a lot of big emphasis on skills, you know, forwards being able to play, you know, Mike Lowe and Geth and these type of guys. Everyone could play the ball. But then Mike brought in with Steve, and it was a second thought, was a scrum the line out. It was it's easy to win. But in the Northern Hemisphere, it's a bit different. It's not, you know, every scrum's competitive. It's not square. There's angles coming everywhere. And then line-outs, it's not easy just to throw to the back.
Yeah.
Because people have been putting pressure on you. So when he came in, that's what his mindset was, Steve Hansen. But when Mike came in, it was, you know, we need a better scrum. We need a better line-out. And picked more where he was playing Mike Lowen in the second row. He put Mike Lowen to number eight.
So he put specialists at specialist positions.
He put myself, I was a tight end, and didn't play Geth in a tight end, really, unless I went off. He brought Brent Cobain and Rob Sidolian, both second rows, big men. You know, Nugget was obviously there, Dav Jones and JT, and, you know, all these type
of guys. Quite a lot of it was selecting the right sort of team then.
Ryan Jones probably burst onto the scene that year as well.
Yeah.
He played a bit, but he kind of came to the fore that year, and, you know, obviously went on the Lions tour off the back of it. Well, or be called up late and play test matches. So he picked the right people, I think. You know, Dwayne Peel was playing well at the time, Stephen was playing well. Tom Shanklin, Gav, great centre partnership, was on the wing. Yeah. Shane was brilliant. You know, Kevin Morgan was playing really well. You know, Reece Williams got injured. Mark Taylor came last minute and played, you know, on the wing. You know, Taylor isn't the fastest in the world, but, you know, he's a really good defender, and, you know, handled, you know, the Irish with any issue whatsoever. So it was good. It was a good group of players, good boys, all gone really well. And then all of a sudden it just goes in a puff of smoke within like a year, you know. So it's what you say, it all goes tits up. So.
Mm. It was 3 years later that Wales won the second Grand Slam that you played in,
yeah.
2008. Warren Gatland had only just arrived.
Yeah.
When that campaign started, again, was there anything that suggested to you, we've got it, you know, it's going to click now? Or
no, when it started, but when certainly he was a different mindset from the off, because with the shocking World Cup in 07, Gats came in, and he was always like, he was always around the region straight away. Speaking to me, he said, like, I want you to play, but you've got to get fitter. So, right, okay, so straight away you're thinking, I need to get fitter, I want to be. He was always around doing stuff. But I always remember the first meeting upstairs in the barn up in the Vale, and Sean Edwards, obviously, Gats introduced Sean Edwards. And for every year of my Welsh career till the point, it was probably 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, there'd always been a reluctance to blitz in defence.
Yeah.
Always been a reluctance to blitz. So Clive Griffiths tried it. No, I was always, oh, I don't know, you know, from the backs and, you know, senior players. And then Roland Phillips tried it. Oh, no, we'd rather drift. Sean Edwards came in and basically said, we're a blitzing defence. If we don't like it, you can F off. There was a few more swear words in it. And he didn't stand up. He just sat in the corner of the room. Sean, anything? We're blitzing defence. If you don't like it, you know, the team. And that was it. And then all of a sudden, the boys who didn't like blitzing learn how to blitz. I want to blitz because they know Sean's.
So that was Sean's first campaign as
yeah,
well, because
yeah.
Warren Gatland brought him in from the
exactly,
old
yeah.
Wasps combination.
Yeah, so that was his first campaign.
So that was what we're all talking about with France at the moment and how he's transformed them. You had that
yeah.
the benefit of that in that
season. It's probably a bit similar. We probably dropped off our fitness levels, like sort of 2007. But when he came in, Gats came in, they wanted the boys fitter. So you already had a fitness coach there, but he brought in Craig White in 2008, just after the Grand Slam.
Yeah.
But he also brought in Paul Strudgeon for a fitness session.
Oh, yeah.
So Bobby, he came in and took a session and during the Six Nations, and we realised we weren't fit enough then, because it was all about this power endurance. So gym, then out into the barn to, like, wrestle and pull and, you know, all sort of functional training and not just bench press and not just, like, you know. If it was bench press, you had to do like 10 sets of 10 in like 5 minutes, almost like a bit CrossFit-y at times. But yeah, so we realised then you had to work hard. And that was Gats' thing. Like before, I always remember it was like born in playtime in international rugby, or in club rugby in Wales, was like 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like international, it's 38. So we've got to be almost 8 minutes
yeah.
more running.
Yeah.
So you've got to be fitter. So, you know, everyone bought into it. And you mean, it was so simple, you know, it was just.
Did that give you confidence that you had stuff in your legs that other nations didn't have?
Well, not probably not at the time, but like certainly it rings true with France now, because they're not fit enough.
Yeah.
France aren't fit enough. You know, they're you know, the way the league structure, the way the league plays. They, you know, you're not going to be fit enough playing that rugby, because
yeah.
it's also 9-10 man rugby. You know, obviously you get the sparks of flair every now and again, but you see how France have dealt with. You know, they're big men, aren't they?
Yeah.
But when they go against like Wales, or we've got as big men who are fitter and stronger, or, you know, playing England with, I don't know, Courtney Laws, Atoji, Launchby, these guys who are big, physical, you know, you don't get as much change out of them as in 9-10 men rugby in France. But no, we knew we weren't fit enough, but there was always like top ups, which never really been done for 4 or 5 years. You know, extra fitness, you know, everyone's doing extra bits, and it was a lot more time in the gym. There was 3 weight sessions a week, whereas before it'd be like one, and one was optional. So it was always like it was a step up in professionalism for me. It was it was brilliant. It was so easy for me. It was like people like myself and Ian Goff. It made it so simple. You know, we're gonna have a target there. You get around the corner, hit rucks. If you carry the ball, carry as hard as you can. But then you go off the floor and you hit the ruck, and then you have to make your tackles. And it wasn't like anything. Oh, we have to reinvent the wheel here, or you have to play like Gethin Jenkins, or you have to play Duncan Jones. You're like, if you hit 35 rucks a game and make 8-9 tackles in a scrum, solid bomb, happy as Larry's, you know, which I enjoyed, you know. It was.
Would he be the first coach that you played with that was so programmed, if you like? He gave you the stats afterwards, which
yeah.
he told you if you'd hit your 35
yeah,
rucks,
yeah,
didn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it'd be on the board as you walk in, so a big board like this. You know, everyone had an individual, how many tackles you made, how many rucks you hit, how many carries, how many mutes lines. So the mutes line was, for example, if the ball has gone to 10 there from a 9, and there's 2 forwards running here. If you're running past with your hands up,
yeah.
to be a dummy line. So it was counted if you were at the ruck, but where you were arriving at the ruck. So if I arrived 5th person at the ruck, you're just like there having the lean, having a rest. So, you know, it's arena, so you want to be 1, 2, 3 at the rack.
And did you like that? Some people, some people might say that that's sort of taken the romance out of it, or the it's made it far more of a science than an art. But
oh no, as a player now, you know every player wants to know, like coaching now, every player wants to know how many tackles they made, how many, you know, times they carried the ball, or how many meters they made, and you know, it's even more now. You've got, you know, how fast you've run, you know how many meters in the game you've run at over 90% of your velocity. So it's not like it's changed so much now. It's even more scientific. And
you were picking this up through that Six Nations campaign.
Yeah, I just love it.
Were you feeling sort of increasingly empowered as you went along?
Yeah, it was brilliant.
You obviously felt it was working for you.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, it was simple. It was effective. Everything was just being more confrontational. Just get over the gain line. You know, if you win the gain line of rugby, it's half the battle sometimes. So it's. I think another thing that stuck in my mind was we played England and beat England in the first game, and it was kind of feedback, you know, with players and coaches sometimes is a bit like, you know, it's hard to take. But what they do, on your sheet, they'd write down any feedback and then come and see them if you wanted it face to face, or they'd come and see you and then write it down. So John Thomas played 6, I think, that day. And in between the 15 metres, he's only supposed to be front 5 carrying the ball around the corner. But he came in and carried one. And Johnny Wilkinson hit him and like knocked him out, and he had to go off. So he got smashed in, running a mute line in between the 15s, which only the front 5 were technically supposed to do.
So he broke Warren's rules then?
Broke Warren's rules, and then underneath his GAT, 60 minutes played.
Oh, this is on his sheet.
On his sheet, 10 tackles, 8 dominant lineouts, ball carries, notes, carried the ball in on a mute in between the 15s, got knocked out, got everything deserved. So, and it was that blend.
Got everything he deserved.
Yeah, it was because he didn't do what he was supposed to do. So it was an eye opener. Like, you know, they tell you to your face as well. It wasn't just, but it was an eye opener to the boys. It was like, oh wow, there's no place hiding here. So.
The sequence of that year was you Wales won at Twickenham, which was the first time for many years, which was obviously was power to your confidence.
Yeah.
Scotland, then the Ireland game, which Shane Williams was so crucial in turning. Italy, the final game against France at home. But there were scrums in that game that were turning points, as much as a Shane Williams try, weren't there?
Well, I certainly think so. Yeah, it was, that's why. Yeah, I live off this one scrum. So it's it was my mate. It was look, we were under the cosh a bit at that time, and they were, I think it was 17-7 maybe, or something close enough, or maybe a bit closer. Yeah, and we just, again, it was well drilled by Gatch, you know, obviously being an ex-hooker, you know, puts a big emphasis on the set piece, understands Northern Hemisphere rugby, where has to, you know, you need a scrum, you need a line-out, and it was just, it all sort of clicked together at the time, and, you know, it was...
But you had a crucial scrum under the post on about the hour mark, didn't you?
Yeah, and we pushed them off the ball, yeah, so it was, it was one of those ones where it sticks in your memory, you know, because we won it, Ryan Jones carried, and Mike Phillips... to push France off their own ball whilst they're attacking, you know, and they had a pretty good side out that day as well. So it was certainly got rid of any demons from 2005 against Marconi out in out in Paris. So it was, to be fair, after I won against Marconi, I did pretty good against France. So until about 2013, so it was huge. It was I always remember John Humphreys telling me after the game. He said that was.
John Humphreys.
It was the Ospreys coach at the time. So
former Wales captain. And
now coach, So he said like that was bigger than Shane's try, bigger than, you know, obviously he's been an ex-hooker.
He said
you guys deserve to celebrate just more as much as these guys. So scrum's a bit, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It can be a pain in the arse regarding time, but still there's nothing better than someone being pushed off the ball or winning a penalty. You know, the crowd still... As much as the crowd mourn and whinge about how long it takes, you know, you can still get as big a cheer as a try sometimes. That day was massive for us. It was huge, confidence-wise, as well for me. You know, going on, you know, to the Lions next year and all this type of stuff. So put me in a, you know, good stead mentally and.
But still, it's almost similar to the 2005. There wasn't such a drop off, but didn't maintain the.
No, we went to South Africa, 2 tough tests, lost them both quite handily. Shane played really well in those. To be fair, we were within the penalty kick of a triple crown the year later in 2009. Ireland kicked the, O'Gara kicked the one to win it, and then Steve missed one sort of 45 metres out to win us the game.
Oh, which would have denied them the grandstand.
Yeah, we would have the triple crown. So yeah, we would have actually come second, I think, if we'd kicked that. But we ended up coming fourth, I think.
The 2011 World Cup was inches or decisions from well, who knows what.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So by the time you came into 2012, I mean, that was the first time I think that you were solid favourites to win it from the start, weren't you? You were no.
Was it? I'm not sure, to be honest. Well,
I haven't gone through the history of the odds, but Wales in 2012 on the back.
I think after the World Cup,
back of the World Cup, people were. I think the point I'm trying to make is that the 05 and 08 sort of came out of you surprised people. Yeah. And now there was expectation, which is a different thing to do.
I think we had a kind of, what we had at the time, we had sort of like myself, Gethin, Matthew Rees or Hugh Bennett around the World Cup time. But then you had, you know, Alan Wynne, Ian Evans, both still quite young, but had been around a bit. But then you had the Warburtons, the Lydiates are coming on, the Faletows are coming on the scene, Tippericks. So you got four sort of world-class...
George North had just arrived.
George North, John Davis hadn't been around that long, you know.
And yeah, so there's like a new generation.
Yeah, so you had an older generation who'd been around a while, but then you had all these young, like, superstars coming through.
Yeah.
And, like, in 4 or 5 years, going to be, you know, world stars. And, you know, it was a nice sort of blend at the time, you know.
There was only three members of the 05 team that were still there in 2012. Yeah, yourself and Gethin Jenkins and Ryan Jones.
Yeah.
That's quite an achievement.
That was brilliant, yeah. When did I see the game? I watched it not long ago, probably a year ago, actually. But, it was me and Gethin started and Ryan came off the bench. And
in which game was that?
In the Grand Slam game. And, I definitely knew that it was if I win three, I would be there with the other, you know, the 70s guys. You know, Gerald, JPR and Gareth and these guys. And in fairness to Gerald and most of them, they're all pretty good. You know, they're always quite supportive.
All right,
but a lot of them aren't. You know, they're quite negative. Oh, it was great in my day, and they still are now. JJ Williams was bagging Dan Bigger last year.
Yeah,
I'm like, the game is so far removed from what you were brilliant in the 70s, no doubt. But you know, it's a different game now. Even professionalism is just.
But you said something that's quite interesting. So you were actually quite motivated to try and match them with the third.
Yeah, yeah.
That meant something quite a lot. To
massively,
you.
Yeah. I think not just those three guys specifically.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of era who.
Yeah.
Who after the first Grand Slam were like, oh, it's a flash in the pan. You know, these boys aren't that good. They're not as good as us. And then even after the second one, it's like, oh yeah, okay, they've only won. You know, so that I always found some boys maybe not, but I always found them very, I say them, the 70s players very like dismissive of what the modern day were doing.
Right.
Like it was always better in our day and that type of thing. That's how I always found it. And I guess being criticised by Bobby Windsor, early doors, Graham Price, early doors.
Yeah.
That probably rankled me a bit. As I said, Bobby Windsor said I was Wales' most important player in his book. So I'd obviously, as I said, won him round in the end, but which was amazing. And
But they were all part of the background cast of characters in your career.
Yeah, in my head as well. Maybe I might be totally wrong, but that's how I saw it. And I'll make a point. I'll happily make a point that you know we did what they did. You know, we won three Grand Slams in and a championship in 7 years.
Yeah.
You know, even another one now, I guess, but spans a bit of a longer generation, golden generation, if you will. But yeah, it's something. Yeah, he used to wind me up a little bit.
Clearly.
Yeah, I know, yeah. So I don't know, I shouldn't have, but I think it's very much like my mother in that respect. She's very very angry. Very angry about anything, anyone who criticises.
But she's angry, but you're not angry.
But little things, if I do wind myself up, that was one thing, it was like my pet hate.
Was it?
Yeah.
How you couldn't be as good as the 70s.
Yes, and how they would be... what's the word? They'd always have like the columns in the paper, and you know people say you don't read the paper for your scores or whatever. We'll see what the press said, but the majority of people would read the paper, you know, to see what you guys have said or Andy Howell has said something like this. So it's I used to read the paper and see what they, you know, when we were in the dark days, when we were getting like 2006, 2007, when we were struggling, and then we, you know, any chance they'd have, you know, they'd have a pop. Well, like JJ did with Dan Bigger now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like if Martin Williams or these type of guys, well, not so Martin, I was a Welsh team manager, but a player who'd played in this era, in the professional era, like, I, you know, you can take it with a pinch of salt, but they're not like the guys from the 70s because they weren't as good.
Yeah.
So, but like, Yeah, so sending it away is always when we up a little bit.
Can you look at your three Grand Slams and say which is your favourite?
Oh, that one, I think.
The third one?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Just because I kind of offered more. I was obviously played for the Lions, had done well in the World Cup. I was more of a leader in the team. Not a particularly vocal leader, but I was more of a senior player. I just felt they offered a lot more. Like the first one, in 05, didn't offer much really, just set piece. 2008, I was just kind of coming into, a year later, coming into my own a bit. It was just something was new. But this one, as I'd been around a while, I was sort of almost 9 years into, 8, 9 years into Test match rugby, and just felt garnered a sort of, like, got a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, you get that reputation, and it's there to be, knocked, and, people challenge you, and opposition see you as an area of strength, and they want to go at you, and I felt I held my own that campaign pretty well.
If you were to counsel or advise someone how to win a Grand Slam, I mean, you've seen it done three times in three different ways.
Yeah,
can you work out how it's done?
Obviously, you need a bit of luck, don't you? But you need everyone. You need everyone on the same page. You need everyone going in the same direction. As soon as it is key, the boys who aren't playing. If you've got a squad of 32, you need the 8 boys who aren't playing. You need them going in the right direction as well. And we've been lucky when I've been involved that there's never been any like negative influences. There's always these boys, wanting to do as well in training for the starters. So that's a big thing, I think. And I think Clive Woodward talked about sappers and stuff years ago, didn't he? And if you've got any sappers or negative influences, then it's doubly hard for you. But so they play a massive part, and you need that bit of luck, and then when you get that momentum, you've just got to embrace it.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.